Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the coded racial politics that Trump used in his campaign and continues to deploy in his presidency, with an escalating fury of late in which his dog whistles have turned into a howl. Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class, joins us to discuss the race-class narrative project he is part of that seeks to educate the 99% of Americans who are being manipulated into manufactured racial and cultural divisions to serve the interests of the 1%. We will examine how Trump is the ultimate test case of this strategy, since he ran as a populist but rules as a plutocrat. And in collusion with Fox News, Trump continually riles up his base with racial resentment to get them to vote against their own interests while distracting Americans from realizing that whites, blacks, and browns have so much more in common with each other than they do with the billionaires. Meanwhile, the billionaires are afraid of real democratic representation and have managed to disguise plutocratic rule by buying politicians and dressing up elections with the trappings of democracy. Then we'll speak with the distinguished American philosopher Martha Nussbaum about her new book, Just Out, At a Time of Stark Political Polarization and Cultural Distress, The Monarchy of Fear. A philosopher looks at our political crisis. She joins us to discuss how the political is always emotional and that Trump essentially practices the politics of blame and resentment using the weapon of fear that is both primal and universal. Then finally, we'll assess the nationwide effort by newspapers, big and small, liberal and conservative, to push back against Trump's dangerous demagoguery, branding journalists the enemy of the people as he whips up his supporters at rallies to curse and confront the press doing their job covering America's president. Michael Cohen, a regular contributor to the Boston Globe, which began the nationwide effort to defend journalists and journalism, joins us to discuss his latest article at the Boston Globe, Trump Escalates a Dangerous War on the Press. And joining us now is Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America. A former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools, his latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Haney-Lopez.
Glad to join you.
And it does seem that Donald Trump, who has been dog whistling since he started the Bertha canard with Barack Obama when Obama was president, and he put forth this idea that the president was illegitimate, he didn't have an American birth certificate, he was a Kenyan interloper and an anti-colonial troublemaker. Since he's been elected, he's intensified, but now it's almost, the dog whistle has almost turned into a howl.
I think it's important to understand what we mean by dog whistle. And I think what we're trying to get at with dog whistle is that you have politicians who are intentionally using racially charged language to animate animosity or fear and resentment in their base. But this is language that at the same time allows them to deny, at least to their base, that they're doing any such thing. And so here, when we think about Trump, I think many of us understand that Trump is engaged in racial demagoguery. But we should be clear, his base does not believe that. So there was a really interesting poll that was done week before the election, and the question in the poll was, do you think the word racist describes Donald Trump? And among Clinton voters, the overwhelming majority says, you bet. But among Trump supporters, 87% said no, and only 5% said yes. So Trump's supporters do not believe that he is engaged in racial demagoguery. They think that what he's communicating is common sense, to use a phrase that Trump himself uses an awful lot. Though I think it's very important that what's passing for common sense for them are deeply internalized racial fears and myths.
But the Bertha conspiracy that he ginned up, and basically that launched his political career, if you will, it seems to me that that Bertha conspiracy, in effect, gave Americans who were restrained by what they call political correctness and essentially gave them permission to speak openly in racist terms.
I agree with an awful lot of what you said, except for the openly in racist terms. So listen, here you have the election of the first black president. If this were open racism, you would have heard people saying, I can't believe we just elected an N-word to the White House. That's open racism. The reason the Bertha claim worked so powerfully was because it was a way of talking about racial difference while using non-racial, seemingly non-racial language. So it wasn't, oh, N-word. It was, I don't think he was actually born here. It wasn't, can't stand a black man. It was, I actually think he's Muslim. And so these phrases, so half of Republican voters came to believe that Barack Obama was Muslim. Did it have anything to do with his religious practice? No. It was all about his race, but it was a way for them to express racial doubt without using racial language. So that people who were very fearful of a black man in the White House could say publicly and say internally to themselves, I'm worried about this foreign-born Muslim. It expressed profound doubt rooted in race, but the way it was expressed was not openly racist.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Haney-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. So I guess the question then would be, why does it work in terms of President Trump's dog whistles? And by the way, he more or less admitted recently when he went after the NFL players, the black NFL players again, and implied in no uncertain manner that they weren't smart enough to know what they were protesting, which is really, I think, grotesquely racist. The assumption is that he did that because it works. It keeps his base on side and keeps them riled up. But why does it work?
It works because it is essentially the right-wing Republican message of the last half century. So dog whistle politics is a technique that Republicans proposed for the first time in 1963. Their candidate Barry Goldwater tries it in 64. They lose then because whites aren't, you know, haven't deeply internalized the message. By 1968, it works a little bit. By 1972, Richard Nixon's dog whistle politics, he calls it the Southern Strategy. It's a national strategy of appealing, using coded terms to appeal to racial fear, wins in a landslide. Republicans have won a majority of the white vote using coded racial messages in every election from 1968 to today. And it's not just that Republicans have been doing this, but if you think about Fox News, Fox News is 24/7 a bullhorn for messages of racial fear. So what Trump is doing is he's echoing messages that many people on the right have been listening to, have been internalizing, have been absorbing for decades. And it's in that sense, he seems to be speaking to and at the same time generating these real racial fears and anxieties about changing demographics, about changing gender roles, about the appearance of transgender people, about new religions and new cultures and new languages, right? Any society has to confront questions of difference, of belonging, of curiosity, of threat. What we have is a society in which a significant element of our leadership, backed by the biggest concentrations of capital, the corporations, the big donors, the family dynasties, they've decided that they're going to purposefully stoke notions of fear and division. That's what we've been doing for 50 years, and that's the path that was so readily available to Donald Trump in 2016.
So is the purpose, then, of using dog whistles and using race to divide the 99% to enrich the 1%? In other words, to take the focus away from the inequality and the growing inequality as the rich get richer and the middle class is stagnant and the working Americans haven't had a raise since the 1970s. Is that the purpose?
I have a two-word answer to that. Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
Donald Trump, a billionaire, so-called self-professed billionaire, who only really cares about his bank account and the bank accounts of people like him, just passed the largest tax cut for billionaires in the history of the country. And 90% of Republican supporters, voters, still support him. Why? Because they're keen on giving money away to billionaires? No. When you look at who voted for Donald Trump, the vast bulk of people who voted for Donald Trump have family incomes between $30,000 and $100,000 a year. This is the working class, lower middle class. They are racially fearful whites who believe that the biggest problem in their lives are people of color or other poor and working class people of color, because that's what they're being told by a wealthy elite who've adopted racism as a divide and distract weapon. The rich are busy writing the rules for themselves, giving themselves big tax cuts, stacking the cabinet with other billionaires, and meanwhile, they're saying to working whites, hey, look over there, it's a black man. He might be on welfare. He's ripping off the system. Oh, hey, look over there, it's a brown-skinned man. I think he might be illegal. It is 100% a divide-and-distract weapon of the 1% against the 99%.
So what will break that mendacious spell? In other words, at what point do working class whites, Latinos, African Americans recognize that they have more in common with each other than they do with the 1% who are basically, you know, taking the cream and leaving them in the lurch?
I think that political revolution, and it is truly the political revolution that we need, that revolution can start today. I have been working with a team of pollsters and linguists and think tanks, and we just completed a study that we're calling the race hyphen class narrative project. It's been written up in The Nation, it's been written up in Salon, it's been written up at The Atlantic, the race class narrative project. And what we proved through national polling is that we have a very powerful story that can unite people across race lines into a truly multiracial class movement. And here's the basic story. They're using race as a divide-and-distract weapon. We come together in cross-racial solidarity. Through cross-racial solidarity, we take back government from the rich. And once we have control of government, we use that to create a broad and shared prosperity for all of us and to promote racial justice. 3 points: cross-racial solidarity, get government back, through government, prosperity, and racial justice. That basic narrative, those three elements, cross-racial solidarity, get government back, shared prosperity, and racial justice, that's a very powerful narrative, and we tested it nationally with over 2,000 people, and that message performs better than the standard Democratic message, which we're calling colorblind economic populism, the sort of, we're going to talk about economics, but we won't address race, works much better than that, because people know we're being racially divided, and they want politicians who are willing to name it. And it also works much better than the right-wing message of racial fear. So there's a way to talk about racism as a weapon of the rich against all of us that works today to defeat dog whistle politics and to lay the groundwork for a truly multiracial working class movement, a truly multiracial democracy, I would say.
And earlier, Ian Hanley-Lopez, you mentioned Nixon's Southern strategy. Prior to that, of course, the Democrats had the Dixiecrats, the Southern white racists. And then when LBJ signed the Voting Rights Act during the Civil Rights period, in 64-65, he said to an aide, the Democrats have just lost the South. And sure enough, Nixon came along and proved that to be the point. So what do you do about that? If you have a kind of core, kind of atavistic part of America that, even though they say we have the new South, it's pretty clear that the Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln, has become the party of the Southern racists, in effect. So how do you deal
with that? Right. There's no doubt that there are regional differences in terms of whites' commitment to the idea that being white is an important aspect of who they are and a source of pride. There's no doubt that there's regional differences. So that said, I mean, I think there are important changes happening in the South. But look, here's what's happened over the last 50 years. One change that's positive, one change that's really negative. The positive change is that the idea of racial equality has continued to spread. It has spread in terms of who we see in our culture, who we see in sports, who we see in business, who we see in politics. I mean, the election and re-election of Barack Obama is really a monumental testament to a spreading idea of equality. Contested, to be sure, but spreading them nonetheless. So that's a positive development. Here's a negative development. Over the last 50 years, the right has been able to use a message of racial fear to convince a majority of whites to support policies that are only good for billionaires, with the result that working people in the United States, working families in the United States, have suffered terrible losses over the last 50 years. Pensions gone, unions gone, home equity gone, health care unaffordable, education unaffordable. And the confluence of those two creates a moment that we've never seen in the history of the United States, a moment when it's possible to say to all Americans, but in a way that's especially convincing to whites, to say to them, listen, racial equality is the way forward, and racism among whites is the biggest threat in the lives of all of us, including in the lives of whites. It's the biggest threat because it's what's empowering people like Donald Trump to rip off the country. Right? And so, and that message, this message is different in 2018 than it would have been in 1968 with Richard Nixon. And the message is different for these two reasons. In 1968, the cultural and material advantages of whiteness were still very high, right? I mean, we had barely contested the idea that whites were a superior race. Most whites continued to assume they were superior, continued to feel consciously or unconsciously that being white was essential to who they were and was evidence of their goodness and all of that nonsense. And at the same time, jobs were segregated, neighborhoods were segregated, schools were segregated. There were substantial material advantages to being white. Both of those have changed. Among many whites, the sort of cultural advantage of being white, they're not invested in that anymore, or not so much, not very much. Whereas the material benefits of being white, completely swamped by the material harm of so many whites voting their racial fears. That, right? And so it's not that people see that. It's not that that's how whites are thinking about it now, but it's what we can convince people of. It's what we can say, hey, listen, you really want to understand what happened over the last 50 years? It wasn't brown-skinned or black-skinned people. It wasn't Asian Americans or Native Americans. It was the very rich, and they rigged the rules, and they robbed the rest of us. And how did they do that? Through racism as a divide and distract. That story can help switch people's perspective on what happened to them and where the threat is coming from and what they need to do to come together to move forward.
Well, you've made it very clear, Ian Haney-Lopez, how race has been weaponized by the GOP. But the other, just in closing, aspect of the GOP is that it's driven by what appears to be a totalitarian impulse. The Democrats have to win at least 8% more votes just to break even. By 2040, there'll be 70 Republican seats in the Senate because of the Electoral College and 30 Democrats. The tide is against them. they don't want just to win in a competition with the Democrats. They want to extinguish them. They want to defund them by stacking the Supreme Court with the Gorsuches and this Kavanaugh character that they want to put on, who will be the final nail in the coffin. So I'd like to get your analysis of, do you recognize that totalitarian impulse, and where does it come from?
It is. I wouldn't say totalitarian. That has a lot of baggage. It has very specific meanings. I would say what's happening is, it is crystal clear that the forces of concentrated wealth, the greedy rich in our society, are profoundly anti-democratic. They do not believe in democracy. So they're quite happy to exploit democratic processes to gain power. For example, by fooling as many voters as they can, by funding different politicians, by essentially buying votes in legislatures. They're quite happy to exploit democratic processes. But at the end of the day, they do not believe in democracy as a project. They actually see democracy as a project as dangerous to them. And so they're willing to back, and the politicians they help get elected, that they fund, are willing to back policies that effectively disenfranchise as many Americans as possible, and especially people who are poor, people who are working class, people who are young, people of color. Right? This is the politics. It's a profoundly anti-democratic politics. Why? Because the project of democracy in every society, the project of democracy is to create a sense of social solidarity, of shared belonging, of linked fate, and to push power and wealth downward and outward. Right? That's the project of democracy. That's what we mean by a democracy that cares about all its members. These folks don't want a democracy. They want a plutocracy. They want rule by the rich. And rule by the rich can take different forms. It can be totalitarian. It can be authoritarianism. The core is it can be a theocracy. They want rule by the rich. And rule by the rich is the antithesis of democracy. So they are, at root, profoundly anti-democratic, at the same time that they consistently seek to exploit democratic processes and democratic norms, and indeed even liberal values like First Amendment, free speech. It's a very, very cynical ploy. They're not interested in democratic values and liberal values. They're interested in rule by the rich. That's what they're funding. That's what they're paying for. That's what they expect to get from the politicians that they bankroll.
Well, Ian Haye-Lopez, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Haye-Lopez, a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, an incisive voice on white identity since the publication of his groundbreaking book, White by Law. He remains at the forefront of conversations about race in modern America, a former professor at Yale and Harvard Law Schools. His latest book is Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the distinguished American philosopher, Martha Nussbaum, about her new book, The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis.
You've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in our game.
Well, I feel just like a child. Yeah, I feel just like a child. Well, I feel just like a child. Well, I feel just like a child. From my womb to my tomb, I guess I'll always be a child. Well, some people try and treat me like a man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Martha Nussbaum, who's the Ernst Freud Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics in the Philosophy Department and the Law School at the University of Chicago. She gave the 2016 Jefferson Lecture for the National Endowment of the Humanities and won the 2016 Kyoto Prize in Arts and Philosophy. She has written more than 22 books, including The Intelligence of Emotions, Anger and Forgiveness, Resentment, Generosity, Justice, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities, and her latest book just out is The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Martha Nussbaum.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. It's a great pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thanks for joining us, Martha. And in terms of the monarchy of fear, it seems to me it's sort of double-edged in a way, in as much as the country is divided, polarized into these kind of irreconcilable silos, 35% supporting Trump and, 55% or more against him. And it's as though, you know, half the country loves him, the other half loathes him. But I see in Trump himself, in terms of the monarch, being afraid. He didn't really, I think, seriously want to become president. I think it was a gambit to increase the brand of the Trump brand. And apparently he was in shock. His wife was in tears the night he was elected. And that Trump, his behavior is propelled by, I think, a deep fear that he has, that he's sort of bitten off more than he can chew. How do you see it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's very perceptive. The book, of course, is not really about Trump. It uses that as an occasion to step back and think about how fear jeopardizes democracy. But yes, from both directions, because fear is an infantile emotion of the helpless baby who can't get anything, and it goes in two directions. In fact, you want to run for comfort to somebody who's bigger than you, who can take care of you, and I think that's what a lot of the electorate is doing. But of course, it's also a reflex of fear that you need to control other people. Go get me what I need, you know. And somebody who is afraid is often likely to be very monarchical and autocratic. And I think we do see that in Trump, absolutely.
Well, he's also trying to stay one step ahead of the sheriff, is he not, with the inquiry by Robert Mueller. And he seems to be getting increasingly hysterical as they close in. There are rumors that there's a sealed indictment against Donald Trump Jr., which really has Trump unhinged, if I can use the title of the new book by his former protege.
Well, what he is so good at doing is diversion, turning the topic from one thing to the other. So the minute this kind of thing you're talking about gets close to him, he turns and creates this diversion with Bolton. And we now know that the letter revoking the security clearance was dated July 26th, but he held it back until he needed a diversion. So, yeah, I think what I say in the book is that very often a reflex of fear is that you create a scapegoat. You try to seize control of your situation by saying, oh, no, I'm not helpless. I can blame it all on this or that. And people do this in all sorts of parts of life. When you're getting divorced, you use punitive litigation to regain control. When your relative dies in the hospital, you think, oh, I'll sue the doctors. They did it. Now, helplessness leads you to want to control things through scapegoating and anger. And that is what Trump does again and again and again. So whenever he's threatened, he finds a scapegoat, whether it's immigrants or John Bolton or whatever, and he just turns the attention toward that.
Well, it seems to me that the scariest combination in politics, particularly when you look at some of the demagogues and dictators in history and indeed in charge of many countries around the world today, that there's nothing more scary than a weak strong man.
Yeah. Well, but also a fearful electorate. And I think this is really the more important thing, because we can't change Donald Trump. I don't particularly have any interest in changing the psychology of Donald Trump, but we can change ourselves and the way we behave to each other. Democracy requires us to keep fear in check. We, of course, got to have some fear, because if we love people and we love our country, there are genuine threats. But we need to critically examine the fear and say, well, are we being manipulated rhetorically when Trump tells us build a wall or blame it all on the immigrants. We have to examine ourselves, and we have to get to a point where we can look each other in the eye with reciprocity and with respect, talk to each other, and get that democracy back on track.
So how do we go from what you just enunciated, Martha Nussbaum, to heal this divide? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but what would the practical steps be?
Well, I think the first practical step is understanding, because I think understanding is deeply practical. I'm following Socrates here, who said, you know, what democracy really needs is for people to lead the examined life. So that's basically why I, a philosopher, am writing a book like this. I think I do have something to offer. But then in the end of the book, I do talk about what I call practices of hope. If we do want to get ourselves back on track and to think hopefully about the future instead of fearfully, in addition to the understanding that I recommend, I think there are different things we can do, and most of them are local, such as getting involved in a local movement of some sort, whether it's just a movement to elect a particular political candidate or whether it's a protest movement within a city. Certainly our city has a number of groups that are very valuable protesting for things like gun control and so on. Or just join a church or synagogue and get involved in its own social efforts to improve the community. In my case, I teach, and that's very rewarding. And I can try to bring people together, you know, not very many of them, of course, but we all do what we can in our own local area. And I even just think talking to your neighbors, talking to your family, because I think most of us have families that are polarized in the same way the nation is. I talk about my own family in the book. And, you know, just talking to them in a new way, it really makes a difference, I find. Today I got a very good reaction to something I wrote from a family member who is a Trump supporter, and I'm so delighted by that because she actually read the thing that I wrote, and she didn't think, oh, a Democrat, I won't look at it. So, you know, that kind of just painstaking effort is part of bringing the country back together.
So, arguably, death is easier than life, and hate is easier than love. Is there a disparity, though, between the anger in this country and the reason that needs to come to the fore and dominate?
Well, you know, I think anger has two parts. There's a protest part where you say, this is wrong, and let's try to correct it. It's got to change. And I think that's very valuable. So I don't think we should give up the protest part of anger. But the other part, which says, oh, and I'll inflict maximum pain on those guys because they did it, that's almost never useful. It's poisonous. It just calls for escalating retribution. Martin Luther King Jr., whom I talk about quite a lot in the book, said that when people came to his movement full of anger, he told them that their anger has to be purified and channelized. So those were the two words he used. And what he meant, clearly, was that they have to keep the protest part and they have to be willing to put themselves on the line and take risks for the sake of what they want to change. But they have to give up this retributive bile and move toward others with an attitude which he called love. But then right away he said, that doesn't mean that you even have to like the people. It just means you have to have a kind of goodwill going forward. They're people you want to respect and work with them to create something new. And I think that is, it's the practical kind of love. It's Christian agape and not friendship and not romantic love, certainly, that we really need in this country.
And indeed, at the monument in Washington, D.C., the MLK monument, it's what's inscribed there is that hate cannot conquer hate, only love can do that. So in terms of what I see as a sort of asymmetry between liberals and conservatives and Republicans and Democrats, Republicans seem to just want to win a lot harder, and they don't care about the niceties and the ideological inconsistencies. We've seen how the Republican Congress has been quite craven in not taking on Trump when he makes the most outrageous statements and acts. Is there an asymmetry there? In other words, liberals would rather be righteous than effective, and Republicans don't care about inconsistencies. They just want to win.
Well, I don't think it's a long-term asymmetry. I mean, if you go back to the New Deal, the Democrats were really determined to win. Now, of course, I myself think the New Deal programs were actually extremely important and right, but look at the way that Roosevelt tried to pack the Supreme Court, which I think was completely illegitimate, and he certainly wanted to get his programs through pretty much at all costs. So I think the Democrats today are waking up. You know, there's a great surge of interest in the midterm elections. I see this in my own city, where the two congressional seats that are held right now by Republicans are being heavily contested, vigorously contested by interesting new people. And, by the way, the Republicans here are not siding with Trump. In fact, they're running quite hard away from Trump because they know that that's what they need to defeat these challengers. So, you know, it's different in every place. But I guess nationally, the Republicans are, by and large, supporting Trump because they see what's out there in a lot of parts of the country is this vigorous base that's going to run another candidate against them and defeat them. So that's their problem. But in terms of the larger electorate, I actually think the Democrats are now waking up and making a good deal of progress.
But how do we, as a country and as a culture, and we are both in political polarization and cultural distress, and it does, I think, it's pretty clear that Donald Trump has used dog whistle politics. That's how he rose to prominence politically, with his canards that against the President Obama, not being an American with a birth certificate, being some kind of Kenyan interloper. It's as though that gave his base, it may have coalesced his base, but it certainly gave them permission to openly express racism. He does on a regular basis. It would seem pretty clear that that racist dog whistles now have turned into almost a howl, but the purpose of them is to divide, and isn't it, between whites, blacks, and browns. We have so much more in common than we do in differences. And basically, the sad truth of the matter is that Trump ran as a populist and governs as a plutocrat. And my sense is that this is what's going on. The 99% are being divided to the benefit of the 1%.
Yeah, although the funny quarrel between Trump and the Koch brothers is quite worth following there. But anyway, yeah, I think that when we see an issue where people really meet each other face to face without suspicion and hostility, things move ahead. I'm thinking of sexual orientation, where it just, of course, it's the truth that in so many families all across the country, they realize they have a child who's gay or their child has a friend who's gay, and they get to know these people and they see them. And since they already knew them before, they have a hard time demonizing them. And so in the end, they might be very upset for a while, but they end up loving and embracing the child that they have. And that doesn't happen with race, because we are de facto segregated and we don't see each other in daily life in the same way, and with the invitation to love and accept. So one thing that I propose at the end of the book is a mandatory national service program for all young people, which would take people out of their neighborhoods so strongly segregated by race and by class, and send them to do work, maybe elder care, child care, all the work that needs doing in this country, in a different place, meeting different people. Because I think part of our problem is we don't see each other and we don't know each other.
And indeed, we did have universal national service that wasn't just military, but conservation, nursing, taking care of the elderly. It would give young Americans, and by the way, they should automatically be registered to vote when they're 18, but it would give young Americans a sense that they have a stake in this country. My greatest sadness about America is the depth of alienation. Trump has tapped into alienation clearly and ran on the politics of resentment and fear. And, you know, you get it both on the left and the right, this sense of powerlessness, you know, and that's why conspiracy theories flourish.
I couldn't agree more. I think with the African-American urban population, Obama gave people a lot of hope and the voter turnout was high, but that didn't translate into ongoing involvement. The African-American turnout plummeted again. So we need to think of that as a major issue. I was very glad that Doug Jones, running in Alabama as a white man, did nonetheless manage to galvanize the African-American voter population. So, you know, I think that can happen. But when young people are busy trying to, you know, get ahead and get good jobs and so on, and they are living in de facto segregation, it's very hard for them to get involved in the real problems of the country. So I think they should go out and do some work. Yes, absolutely. Elder care, nursing, conservation, all the things that you've mentioned.
Well, Martha Nussbaum, I thank you very, very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much. And to all listeners, if you have any questions about the book, I am happy to answer emails, so please do not hesitate to send me one.
And again, I've been speaking with Martha Nussbaum, who's the Ernst Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics in the Philosophy Department and the Law School at the University of Chicago. She gave the 2016 Jefferson Lecture for the National Endowment for the Humanities and won the 2016 Kyoto Prize in Arts and Philosophy. She's written more than 22 books, including The Intelligence of Emotions, Anger and Forgiveness, Resentment, Generosity, Justice, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities, and her latest book just out, that is The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the nationwide efforts by newspapers, big and small, liberal and conservative, to push back against Trump's dangerous demagoguery, branding journalists the enemy of the people. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Cohen, a regular contributor to the Boston Globe on national politics and foreign affairs. He's the author of American Maelstrom, the 1968 Election and the Politics of Division. And he has an article at the Boston Globe, Trump Escalates a Dangerous War on the Press. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cohen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And there's a nationwide effort by newspapers, big and small, liberal and conservative, to push back against Trump's dangerous demagoguery, branding journalists as the enemy of the people. The effort was led by the Boston Globe. But now Trump has responded, and frankly, maybe you can decipher this for me. Let me read his tweet.
Good luck with that. Yeah.
The Boston Globe, which was sold to the failing New York Times for $1.3 billion plus $800 million in losses and investment, or $2.1 billion, was then sold by the Times for $1. Now the Globe is in collusion, in caps, with other papers on free press. Prove it. Prove what? What do you think he's talking about?
I have no idea. I really don't. I mean, he is referring in the first part to the sale of Boston Globe to New York Times and then the purchase of it by its current owner, John Henry. The second part, we talked about the Boston Globe in collusion with other papers on the free press. That is correct. In fact, that's exactly what Boston Globe did today. We, organized a few newspapers around the country to speak out against Trump's war on the press. And you know, I mean, if you look at some of the columns today, editorials today, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary outpouring. And again, as you said, from liberal papers, conservative papers, small papers, big papers, basically all speaking with one collective voice saying, you know, we're not going to be intimidated by this president and we're not going to stop doing our job and seeking out truth.
And is there a sense amongst newspaper owners, editors, reporters, etc., that the what happened at the Capital Gazette in Annapolis recently, where a bunch of journalists in the newsroom were gunned down by somebody that was unrelated to Donald Trump's rhetoric, but nevertheless, it sort of indicates, does it not, that at some point or other, the president's words could be put into action by one of his followers.
It's absolutely the case, and I think you talk to a lot of journalists, a lot of people in the news business these days, and I think the feeling among people is it's a question not if there's going to be some kind of attack, but when. It just the rhetoric has become just so out of bounds of what is appropriate in a democratic society, with the president regularly calling the press enemy of people, suggesting that the press is trying to start wars, that the press is trying to sow conflict and sow division. It's disgusting, frankly, and it's undemocratic, and it puts, I think, journalists at risk. It just takes one person in a society that, frankly, is saturated with guns to act out on the president's words. And I think a lot of journalists feel some level of fear about this. I think at the same time, the president has been warned about this. I mean, he met with the editor of the New York Times a few weeks ago, was just told the dangers that his rhetoric poses. He doesn't care. I think he sees it as a political upside, political positive for him. And I think, everyone should be concerned about this, not just journalists. But obviously journalists are the ones who, I think, at some level of risk because of what the president is saying.
But isn't Trump obviously motivated by concern about wanting this Russia probe to go away? He attacks Mueller all the time. He attacks the DOJ. He attacks the FBI. And he attacks the press for reporting what they are uncovering about Trump's relationship with the Russians and his elections and the extent to which they may have been influenced by Russian meddling. And isn't there a purpose to his attack on the press? He's trying to shoot the messenger so that the message doesn't get through.
Yes, I mean, I think that's right. But I actually just broaden the critique a little bit. I don't think it's just Russia and the Mueller investigation. I think it's everything. I mean, I wrote this today about the first day, first hour or two as president. What happened was that the White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, went out and said that the inauguration crowd at Trump's inauguration was the largest in the U.S. history, which, of course, was not true. And that's a small lie. I mean, it's not the kind of lie that has a huge impact, but it showed the pattern of behavior, which is that this White House will lie about anything, and they will attack any journalist and any reporter who points out the president is lying and deride them as fake news. So you're right. I mean, I agree with you that this is partly about Russia, and it's certainly an effort to discredit whatever Mueller and his team comes up with, but it's more than that. I said this, I wrote this today, that the president is not at war, he's at war, outwardly at war with the media, but in reality, he's at war with truth. And what he wants is to define reality as the way he sees it, not the way it really is. And I think that's the part that is most concerning, because it's not just about the Russian investigation and the campaign and so forth. It's literally everything that he does. And every news story he doesn't like, every news story that criticizes him, every news story that points out embarrassing facts about him, is derided as fake news that was made up by the press. And, I think what's most discouraging about this is that if you look at the numbers among Republican voters, this conspiratorial mindset of Trump is being, imbibed by his followers. Well, you've got, half the Republican voters who basically think that all media is fake news. This is, I think, what's so disturbing about this. And, someday Trump will be gone, thankfully, but we still have to live with the fact that he has convince a broad segment of the Republican Party not to believe anything that goes against their sort of ideological priors and anything that says to them that goes against what they believe, what they want to believe, is fake news. And that journalists are making up these stories, which, of course, is completely untrue.
But in the case of the first big lie that came out of Sean Spicer, where he was literally forced by his boss to say something that was completely insane and was totally disproven by photography, which when you compared the two crowds, it was so clear that Obama had a huge inauguration and Trump's was very, very sparse by comparison. To me, that means that we're dealing with a character in this president somewhat like King Canute. I mean, he's trying to defy the tide, isn't he?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It's the perfect analogy for it. Yeah.
But that's about as scary as it gets, isn't it?
It's terrifying. I mean, you know, look, I think the president, in a lot of ways, just doesn't have a very strong grip on reality. I mean, and that's putting it, I think, you know, putting it nicely. I think he defines reality the way he wants things to be, which is disturbing. I think the part that is even more disturbing is how many people are willing to support this. You know, how many people work in the White House are willing to enable this just constant lying? How many Republicans on the Hill who are willing to just to say nothing as he does this? And, you know, one point I think is worth making here is that, you know, we talk about Trump's lies and Trump's, you know, redefining a reality. It's not just him that's doing this. You know, last year when Republicans were debating, health care and repealing Obamacare, they simply made up things about what their health care bills would do. They made up things about their tax bill. They said the tax bill would help lots of people. In fact, we now know it did not, as many said at the time. So this kind of lying is not just something that you're seeing with Trump. It seems to be just broadly across the Republican Party. There just seems to be no fealty to the truth and no shame in lying and enabling dishonesty, especially when it comes from the White House.
Some of the incidents that you cite in your article are worth repeating, Michael. NBC News' Katie Turr, she spoke this week of getting a message from someone hoping that she is raped and killed. CNN's Brian Seltzer, who along with Don Lemon was threatened on C-SPAN by a caller who said he would like to shoot them because he accused the reporters of labeling Trump supporters as racists, which of course neither Seltzer or Don Lemon had indeed said. And then, you know, then Brett Stevens, the New York Times columnist, the conservative columnist for the New York Times, got a voicemail at his office saying, "I don't carry an AR, but once we start shooting you effers, you aren't going to pop off like you did now. You're worthless. The press is the enemy of the United States people." There's somebody quoting Trump. I mean,
that's a very important point, quoting exactly Trump's rhetoric in threatening a journalist. Absolutely.
So if Trump is tweeting out nonsense, and he's not going to give this up, is he? Because it's almost like he's trying to be one step ahead of the sheriff, and the sheriff's closing in on him, and he's getting more and more strident and perhaps even more hysterical. So I don't see him backing down. What is the solution? Do you think the Republicans, the enablers of this president, will notice in their local newspapers all around the country that people are concerned that this thing could go off the rails and we could have a tragedy?
No. They won't. I mean, I was gratified today to see the Senate pass a resolution unanimously, basically upholding the importance of the free press in American society. The problem, of course, is why this would be necessary. But the reality is that I don't expect Republicans in the Senate or the House to defend the press. I mean, they, I think, in some ways benefit from Trump's attacks on the press. It sort of bolsters the kind of, you know, conservative mindset of resentment against the liberal elite, but for lack of a better term. But I think also, you know, they don't want to turn against Trump. I mean, one thing you've seen in a lot of these Republican primaries is that the people who were Republicans who were losing are Republicans who have dared to criticize the president. And this goes back to criticism, for example, after the Hacks of Hollywood tapes now in 2016. So this is, I think Republicans have unfortunately learned the lesson that their Republican voters will accept anything Trump does and expect Republican politicians to basically support the president no matter what. And I expect them to continue that. Now, will they continue after midterm election if they lose the House and Senate? Maybe not. That was where you might see their behavior shift. Between now and November, I expect absolutely nothing to change as far as Republicans do. With the one caveat that whatever, if Bob Mueller comes out with the support between now and then, that could change things. But barring that, I don't see any real reason to expect Republicans will change and will begin to, you know, hold Trump accountable for the things he says about the free press in America.
But does this current demagoguery and rhetoric against the press, doesn't it have a precedent going back decades with the Republican vilification by coming up with this canard that we have a liberal media? I mean,
right.
How do you see it in that broader context?
I mean, this is very much on a spectrum. It's consistent with Republicans have been saying for years. I mean, I remember back in the 90s, you'd see bumper stickers and, you know, don't trust the liberal media. Yeah, I remember George H.W. Bush running on that message in 92. The difference, I think, now is that Trump has the rhetoric from Trump is so much more polarizing, demonizing, vitriolic, that it's you're entering, and to what I said earlier, I fear that it is encouraging people, spurring people to consider acts of violence. I don't think I would have said that 10, 15 years ago. There were vicious and harsh attacks against the press from Republicans going back, you know, years, but not on this level and not as dangerous as Trump's rhetoric has been. And I think above all, it's that the Trump, his attacks on the media is really, again, attacks on reality, attacks on truth. He wants to see the world a certain way, and when it's presented in a way that differs from the way he wants it to be, he lashes out. It's like a child in many respects. And I think what you're seeing is like the sort of childlike response to things he doesn't like. And the way he responds to it is by being a bully and by threatening reporters with violence. And I don't think he even understands or comprehends or appreciates how dangerous this is. I don't think he cares either, frankly.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I think it was the rally down in Florida or maybe the subsequent rally, because he does have regular rallies, where he really turned on the press and he was pointing to them in the back of the room. And frankly, that they're doing their job. They're covering the President of the United States. The President of the United States, by definition, makes news. And he was sort of sicking the crowd.
Every Trump rally that I went to during the campaign, he used to attack, he used to point to us in the pen where we were sitting and basically say, they're the worst, they're terrible, they lie. I mean, this is going back 3 years now.
But I noticed on his face when he was saying they're disgusting, he was just, the anger was palpable. The hatred was palpable.
I think it's true. I think, you know, I think he, again, I mean, I think anyone who, I think Trump views the world through people who are nice to him and people who are not nice to him. And so I think he views reporters who don't say what he wants them to say are not nice to him. And, you know, the Fox News reporters who say what he wants to hear, they're the ones who are nice to him. I mean, I think as simplistic as that may be, that's how he defines the world. You know, I mean, you have somebody who's president who is not, you know, terribly stable and terribly a well person, and yet he's able to do and say these things with none of his political allies willing to challenge it.
Well, Michael Cohen, thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a regular contributor to the Boston Globe on national politics and foreign affairs. He's the author of American Maelstrom, the 1968 Election and the Politics of Division. And he has an article at the Boston Globe, Trump Escalates a Dangerous War on the Press. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Marshall. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.